Disc 2.
Chapter 19. Grandpa's library was a fine, dark place bricked with books, so anything could happen there, and always did. All you had to do was pull a book from the shelf and open it, and suddenly the darkness was not so dark anymore. Here it was that Grandpa sat in place, with now this book and now that in his lap, and his gold specks on his nose, welcoming visitors who came to stay for a moment and lingered for an hour. Even Grandmother paused here after some burdensome time, as an aging animal seeks the watering place to be refreshed. And Grandfather was always here to offer cups of good, clear Walden Pond, or shout down the deep well of Shakespeare and listen with satisfaction for echoes. Here the lion and the hartebeest lay together. Here the jackass became unicorn. Here on Saturday noon an elderly man could be found underneath a not-too-imaginary bough, eating bread in the guise of sandwiches and pulling briefly at a jug of cellar wine. Douglas stood on the edge of it all, waiting.
"Step forward, Douglas," said Grandfather.
Douglas stepped forward, holding the gunny sack in one hand behind his back.
"Got anything to say, Douglas?"
"No, sir."
"Nothing at all about anything?"
"No, sir."
"What you been up to today, son?"
"Nothing."
"A busy nothing or a nothing-nothing?"
"A nothing-nothing, I guess."
"Douglas."
Grandpa paused to polish his gold-rimmed specs.
"They say that confession is good for the soul."
"They do say that."
"And they must mean it, or they wouldn't say it."
"I guess so."
"Know it, Douglas. Know it."
"Got anything to confess?"
"About what?"
said Douglas, keeping the gunny sack behind him.
"That's what I'm trying to find out. You going to help?"
"Maybe you could give me a hint, sir?"
"All right. Seems there was flood tide down at City Hall Courthouse today. I hear a tidal wave of boys inundated the grass. You know any of them?"
"No, sir."
"Any of them know you?"
"If I don't know them, how could they know me, sir?"
"Is that all you got to say?"
"Right now, yes, sir."
Grandpa shook his head.
"Doug, I told you. I know about the purloins. And I'm sorry you think you can't tell me about them. But I remember being your age and getting caught red-handed at doing something I knew I shouldn't do, but I did anyway. Yes, I remember."
Grandpa's eyes twinkled behind his specs.
"Well, I think I'm holding you up, boy. I think you got somewhere to go."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, try to hurry it up. The rain's still coming down, lightning all over town, and the town square is empty. If you run and let the lightning strike, maybe you'll do a fast job of what you should be doing. Does that sound reasonable, Doug?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, then, get to it."
Douglas started to back away.
"Don't back off, son," said Grandpa. "I'm not royalty. Just turn around and skedaddle."
"Skedaddle? Was that originally French, Grandpa?"
"Hell."
The old man reached for a book.
"When you get back, let's look it up."
Chapter 20. Just before midnight, Doug woke to that terrible boredom that only sleep ensures. It was then, listening to Tom's chuffing breath, deep in an ice-flow summer hibernation, that Doug lifted his arms and wiggled his fingers like a tuning fork. A gentle vibration ensued. He felt his soul move through an immense timberland. His feet, shoeless, drifted to the floor, and he leaned south to pick up the gentle radio waves of his uncle down the block. Did he hear the elephant sound of Tantor summoning an ape boy? Or, half through the night, had Grandpa, next door, fallen in a grave of slumber, dead to the world, gold specks on his nose, with Edgar Allan Poe shelved to his right and the Civil War dead, truly dead, to his left, waiting in his sleep, it seemed, for Doug to arrive. So, striking his hands together and wiggling his fingers, Doug made one final vibration of his literary tuning fork and moved with quiet intuition toward his grandparents' house. Grandpa, in his grave of sleep, whispered a call. Doug was out the midnight door so fast he almost forgot to catch the screen before it slammed. Ignoring the elephant trumpet behind, he barefooted into his grandparents' house. There in the library slept Grandpa, awaiting the breakfast resurrection, open for suggestions. Now, at midnight, it was the unlit time of the special school, so Doug leaned forward and whispered in Grandpa's ear, 1899. And Gramps, lost in another time, murmured of that year and how the temperature was and what the people were like moving in that town. Then Douglas said, 1869. And Grandpa was lost 4 years after Lincoln was shot. Standing there, watching, Douglas realized that if he visited here night after night and spoke to Grandpa, Grandpa, asleep, would be his teacher, and that if he spent 6 months or a year or 2 years coming to this special long-after-midnight school, he would have an education that nobody else in the world would have. Grandpa would give his knowledge as a teacher without knowing it, and Doug would drink it in and not tell Tom or his parents or anybody. "That's it," whispered Doug. "Thank you, Grandpa, for all you say, asleep or awake. And thanks again for today and your advice on the purloins. I don't want to say any more. I don't want to wake you up." So Douglas, his ears full up and his mind full brimmed, left his grandpa sleeping there and crept toward the stairs and the tower room because he wanted to have one more encounter with the night town and the moon. Just then, the great clock across town, an immense moon, a full moon of stunned sound and round illumination, cleared its ratchety throat and let free a midnight sound. 1. Douglas climbed the stairs. 2, 3, 4, 5. Reaching the tower window, Douglas looked out upon an ocean of rooftops and the great monster clock tower as time summed itself up. 6, 7. His heart floundered. 8, 9. His flesh turned to snow. 10, 11. A shower of dark leaves fell from 1,000 trees. 12. Oh my God, yes, he thought. The clock. Why hadn't he thought of that? The clock! Chapter 21. The last vibration of the great clock bell faded. A wind swayed the trees outside, and the picot curtain hung out on the air, a pale ghost. Douglas felt his breath siphon. "You," he thought. "How come I never noticed?" The great and terrible courthouse clock. Just last year, hadn't Grandpa laid out the machinery's blueprint, lecturing? The huge round lunar clock was a grist mill, he'd said. Shake down all the grains of time, the big grains of centuries and the small grains of years and the tiny grains of hours and minutes, and the clock pulverized them, slid time silently out in all directions in a fine pollen, carried by cold winds to blanket the town like dust everywhere. Spores from that clock lodged in your flesh to wrinkle it, to grow bones to monstrous size, to burst feet from shoes like turnips. Oh, how that great machine at the town center dispensed time in blowing weathers. The clock! That was the thing that bleached and ruined life, jerked people out of bed, hounded them to schools and graves. Not Quartermain and his band of old men, or Brayling and his metronome. It was the clock that ran this town like a church. Even on the clearest of nights, it was misted, glowing, luminous, and old. It rose above town like a great, dark burial mound, drawn to the skies by the summoning of the moon, calling out in a grieved voice of days long gone and days that would come no more, whispering of other autumns when the town was young and all was beginning and there was no end.
"So it's you," whispered Douglas.
"Midnight," said the clock.
"Time," it said. "Darkness."
Flights of nightbirds flew up to carry the final peal away, out over the lake and into the night country, gone. Doug yanked down the shade so time could not blow through the screen. The clock light shone on the sidings of the house like a mist breathing on the windows. Chapter 22.
"Boy, I just heard the craziest things."
Charlie strolled up, chewing on a clover blossom.
"I got me a Secret Service report from some girls."
"Girls?"
Charlie smiled at how his 10-inch firecracker had blown the laziness off his pals' faces.
"My sister said way back last July they got old Lady Bentley to admit she never was young. I thought you'd like that news."
Charlie,
"Burden of proof," said Charlie. "The girls told me that old Lady Bentley showed some pictures, junk and stuff, which didn't prove nothing. Fact is, when you think on it, fellas, none of these old ginks look like they were ever young."
"Why didn't you think of that, Doug?"
said Tom.
"Why don't you shut up?"
said Douglas.
"I guess this makes me a lieutenant," said Charlie.
"You just moved up to sergeant yesterday."
Charlie stared hard at Douglas for a long moment.
Okay, you're a lieutenant," said Douglas.
"Thanks,"
said Charlie.
"What'll we do about my sister? She wants to be part of our army, a special spy."
"To heck with her.
You gotta admit, that's great secret stuff she turned in."
"Boy, Charlie, you sure think of things,"
said Tom.
"Doug, why don't you think of things?"
"Darn it," cried Douglas. "Whose idea was the graveyard tour, the candy, the food, the chess pieces, all that?"
"Hold on," said Tom. "The graveyard tour, I said that. The candy, yeah, was yours, but I gotta tell you, the food experiment was a failure. Heck, you haven't said anything new in a couple of hours. And all the chess boards are full of chess pieces again, and those old men are busy pushing the pieces, us, around. Any minute now, we'll feel ourselves grabbed and moved, and we won't be able to live our own lives anymore."
Douglas could feel Charlie and Tom creeping up on him, taking the war out of his hands like a ripe plum. Private, corporal, sergeant, lieutenant. Today, lieutenant, tomorrow, captain. And the day after?
"It's not just ideas that count."
Douglas wiped his brow.
"It's how you stick 'em together. Take this fact of Charlie's. It's secondhand. Heck, girls thought of it first."
Everybody's eyebrows went up. Charlie's face fell.
"And anyway," Douglas went on, "I'm putting ideas together for a real bang-up revelation."
They all looked at him, waiting.
"Okay, Doug, go on," said Charlie.
Douglas shut his eyes.
"And the revelation is, since old people don't look like they were ever kids, they never were. So they're not humans at all."
"What are they, Doug?"
"Another race."
Everybody sat, stunned by the vast sunburst caused by this explosion, this incredible revelation. It rained upon them in fire and flames.
"Yes, another race," said Douglas. "Aliens, evil, and we're the slaves they keep for nefarious odd jobs and punishments."
Everybody melted with the after effects of this announcement. Charlie stood up solemnly and announced,
"Doug, old pal, see this beanie on my head? I'm taking my beanie off to you."
Charlie raised his beanie to applause and laughter. They all smiled at Doug, their general, their leader, who took out his pocket knife and casually started a philosophical game of one-finger mumbly-peg.
"Yeah, but," said Tom, and went on, "the last thing you said didn't work out. It's okay to say the old people are from another planet, but what about Grandpa and Grandma? We've known them all our lives. Are you saying that they're aliens, too?
Doug's face turned red. He hadn't quite worked this part out, and here was his brother, his second in command, his junior officer, questioning his theory.
And, Tom went on, what do we have new in the way of action, Doug? We can't just sit here. What do we do next?
Doug swallowed hard. Before he had a chance to speak, Tom, now that everybody was looking at him, said slowly,
"The only thing that comes to mind right now is maybe we stop the courthouse clock. You can hear that darn thing ticking all over town. Bong, midnight, wang, get out of bed, boom, jump into bed, up, down, over and over."
Oh my gosh, thought Douglas. I saw it last night. The clock. Why in heck didn't I say so first? Tom picked his nose calmly.
Why don't we just lambaste that darn old clock? Kill it dead. Then we can do whatever we want to do whenever we want to do it. Okay?
Everyone stared at Tom. Then they began to cheer and yell, even Douglas, trying to forget it was his younger brother, not himself, who was saving the day.
Tom, they all shouted. Good old Tom.
Ain't nothing, said Tom.
He looked to his brother.
When do we kill the blasted thing?
Douglas bleated, his tongue frozen. The soldiers stared, waiting.
Tonight?
Said Tom.
I was just going to say that, Douglas cried.
Chapter 23. The courthouse clock somehow knew they were coming to kill it. It loomed high above the town square with its great marble facade and sun-blazed face, a frozen avalanche waiting to bury the assassins. Simultaneously, it allowed the leaders of its religion and philosophy, the ancient gray-haired messengers of time and dissolution, to pass through the thundering bronze doors below. Douglas, watching the soldiery of death and mummification slip calmly through the dark portals, felt a stir of panic. There in the shellac-smelling, paper-rustling rooms of Town Hall, the Board of Education, slyly unmade destinies, paired calendars, devoured Saturdays in torrents of homework, instigated reprimands, tortures, and criminalities. Their dead hands pulled streets straighter, loosed rivers of asphalt over soft dirt to make roads harder, more confining, so that open country and freedom were pushed further and further away, so that one day, years from now, Green Hills would be a distant echo, so far off that it would take a lifetime of travel to reach the edge of the city and peer out at one lone small forest of dying trees. Here in this one building, lives were slotted, alphabetized in files and fingerprints, the children's destinies put under seal, men with blizzard faces and lightning-colored hair, carrying time in their briefcases, hurried by to serve the clock, to run it with great sprockets and gears. At twilight, they stepped out, all smiles, having found new ways to constrict, imprison, or entangle lives in fees and licenses. You could not even prove your death without these men, this building, this clock, and a certificate duly inked, stamped, and signed.
"Here we are," whispered Douglas, all his pals clustered around him. "It's almost quitting time. We gotta be careful. If we wait too long, it'll be so shut up there'll be no way to get in. Right at twilight, when the last doors are being locked, that's when we make our move, right? As they come out, we go in."
"Right," said everyone.
"So," said Douglas, "hold your breath."
"It's held," said Tom.
"But, Doug, I got something to say."
"What?" said Doug.
"You know that no matter when we go in, if we go in all together, someone's going to see us, and they're going to remember our faces, and we're going to get in trouble. It was bad enough with the chess pieces out front of the courthouse. We were seen, and we had to give everything back. So why don't we wait until it's all locked up?"
"We can't do that. I just said why."
"Tell you what," said Tom, "why don't I go in now,
and hide in the men's until everyone's gone home. Then I'll sneak upstairs and let you in one of the windows near the clock tower. Up there on the third floor.
He pointed to a spot high up the ancient brick walls.
Hey, said all the gang.
That won't work, said Doug.
Why not? Said Tom.
Before Doug had time to think of a reason, Charlie piped up.
Sure it'll work, said Charlie. Tom's right. Tom, you want to go in and hide now?
Sure, said Tom.
Everyone was looking at Doug, still their general, and he had to give his approval.
What I don't like, said Doug, is smart Alecks who think they know everything.
Okay, go in and hide. When it gets dark, let us in.
Okay,
said Tom, and he was gone. People were coming out through the big bronze doors, and Doug and the others pulled back around the corner of the building and waited for the sun to go down. Chapter 24. The courthouse was finally completely quiet, and the night was dark, and the boys climbed up the fire escape on the side of the building very quietly until they got up to the third floor near the clock tower. They stopped at the window where Tom was supposed to appear, but no one was there.
Gosh, said Doug, I hope he didn't get locked in the men's room.
They never lock the men's room, said Charlie. He'll be here.
And sure enough, all of a sudden, there was Tom behind the glass pane, waving to them and opening and shutting his mouth, but they couldn't hear what he was saying. At long last, he raised the window, and the smell of the courthouse rushed out into the night around them.
Get in, commanded Tom.
We are, said Doug angrily.
One by one, the boys crawled inside the courthouse and snuck along the hallways till they reached the clock machinery door.
I bet you, said Tom, this darn door's locked too.
No bets, said Doug and rattled the doorknob.
Good grief!
Tom, I hate to say it, but you're right. Has anybody got a firecracker?
Suddenly, six hands reached into six dungaree pockets and just as suddenly reappeared with 3 4-inchers and a few 5-inch crackers.
It's no good, said Tom, unless someone has matches.
More hands reached out with matches in each. Doug stared at the door.
How can we fix the crackers so they'll really do some good when they go off?
Glue, said Tom.
Doug shook his head, scowling.
Yeah, glue, right. He said. Does anyone just happen to have any glue on them?
A single hand reached out on the air. It was Pete's.
Here's some bulldog glue, he said. Bought it for my airplane models, and because I like the great picture of the bulldog on the label.
Let's give it a try.
Doug applied glue along the length of one of the 5-inchers and pressed it against the outside of the machinery room door.
Stand back, he said.
And struck a match. With his mob back in the shadows and his hands over his ears, Doug waited for the cracker to go off. The orange flame sizzled and zipped along the fuse. There was a beautiful explosion. For a long moment, they all stared at the door in disappointment, and then, very slowly, it drifted open.
I was right, said Tom.
Why don't you just shut up,
said Doug.
Come on!
He pulled the door and it opened wide. There was a sound below.
Who's there?
A voice cried from deep down in the courthouse.
Oh my gosh, whispered Tom. I bet that's the janitor.
Who's up there?
The voice cried again.
Quick, said Doug, leading his army through the door.
And now at last, they were inside the clock. Here, suddenly, was the immense, frightening machinery of the enemy, the teller of lives and time. Here was the core of the town and its existence. Doug could feel all of the lives of the people he knew moving in the clock, suspended in bright oils and meshed in sharp cogs and ground down in clamped springs that clicked onward with no stopping. The clock moved silently, and now he knew that it had never ticked. No one in the town had ever actually heard it counting to itself. They had only listened so hard that they had heard their own hearts, and the time of their lives moving in their wrists and their hearts and their heads. For here was only cold metal silence, quiet motion, gleams and glitters, murmurs, and faint whispers of steel and brass. Douglas trembled. They were together at last, Doug and the clock that had risen like a lunar face throughout his life at every midnight. At any moment the great machine might uncoil its brass springs, snatch him up and dump him in a grinder of cogs to mesh its endless future with his blood in a forest of teeth and tines, waiting like a music box to play and tune his body, ribboning his flesh. And then, as if it had waited just for this moment, the clock cleared its throat with a sound like July thunder. The vast spring hunched in upon itself as a cannon prepares for its next concussion. Before Douglas could turn, the clock erupted. 1, 2, 3! It fired its bells, and he was a moth, a mouse in a bucket being kicked and kicked again. An earthquake shook the tower, jolting him off his feet. 4, 5, 6! He staggered, clapping his hands over his ears to keep them from bursting. Again, again, 7, 8! The tempest tore the air. Shaken, he fell against the wall, eyes shut. His heart stopped with each storm of sound. Quick! Douglas shouted. The crackers! Kill the darn thing! Shouted Tom. I'm supposed to say that! Said Doug. Kill it! There was a striking of matches and a lighting of fuses, and the crackers were thrown into the maw of the vast machine. Then there was a wild stomping and commotion as the boys fled. They bolted through the third floor window and almost fell down the fire escape, and as they reached the bottom, great explosions burst from the courthouse tower, a great metal racketing clangor. The clock struck again and again, over and over as it fought for its life. Pigeons blew like torn papers tossed from the roof. Bong! The clock voice chopped concussions to split the heavens. Ricochets, grindings, a last desperate twitch of hands. Then, silence. At the bottom of the fire escape, all the boys gazed up at the dead machine. There was no ticking, imagined or otherwise. No singing of birds, no purr of motors. Only the soft exhalations of sleeping houses. At any moment, the boys, looking up, expected the slain tower face, hands, numerals, guts, to groan, slide, and tumble in a grinding avalanche of brass intestines and iron meteor showers, down, down upon the lawn, heaping, rumbling, burying them in minutes, hours, years, and eternities. But there was only silence, and the clock, a mindless ghost, hanging in the sky with limp, dead hands, saying naught, doing nothing. Silence, and yet another long silence, while all about lights blinked on in houses, bright winks stretching out into the country, and people began to come out on porches and wonder at the darkening sky. Douglas stared up, all drenched with sweat, and was about to speak when,
"I did it!" cried Tom.
"Tom!" cried Doug.
"We! All of us did it!"
"But good grief, what did we do?"
"Before it falls on us," said Tom, "we'd better run."
"Who says?" said Douglas.
"Sorry," said Tom.
"Run!" cried Doug, and the victorious army ran away into the night.
Chapter 25. It was the middle of the night, and Tom still couldn't sleep. Doug knew this because several times he heard Tom's bedclothes fall to the floor, as if he were tossing and turning, and each time he heard the sound of the sheets and coverlet being reassembled. At about 2 in the morning, Doug went down to the icebox and brought a dish of ice cream up to Tom, which he figured might cause Tom to speak more freely. Tom sat up in bed and hardly touched the ice cream. He sat there staring at it as it melted, and then said,
"Doug, an awful thing has happened."
"Yeah, Tom," said Doug.
"We thought if we stopped the big courthouse clock, we might stop the old people from holding on to stealing our time. But nothing's been stopped, has it?"
"No, sir,"
said Doug.
I mean, said Tom, time's still moving. Nothing's changed. Running home, I looked at all the lights around us, and none of them had gone out. I saw some policemen in the distance, down the street, and they hadn't been stopped. I kept waiting for all the lights to go out or something to happen to show that we'd really done something. Instead, it looked as if someone might have been hurt. I mean, when you think about Will and Beau and the others kind of limping home from the courthouse, I've got a feeling nobody's going to sleep tonight. And maybe when they do get to sleep, they'll sleep late. My gosh, they're going to lie around doing nothing, staying in bed, keeping quiet. And here I am for the first time in years, wide awake. I can't even shut my eyes. What are we going to do about it, Doug? I mean, you kept saying we had to kill the clock, but how do we make it live again if we have to?
The clock wasn't alive, said Doug softly.
But you said, said Tom. Well, I said, guess I started it. We all kept saying that we had to do it in, so we did. But what now?
It looks like we'll all be in trouble now, Tom finished. Only me, said Doug. Grandpa will give me a talking to.
But we went along, Doug. It was swell. We liked it. We had fun. But now, if the clock was never alive, how do we bring it back from the dead? We can't have it both ways, but something's got to be done. What's next?
Maybe I've got to go down to the courthouse and sign some sort of paper, said Doug. I could tell them I'll give them my allowance for 8 or 10 years so they can fix that clock.
Oh my gosh, Doug!
That's about the size of it, said Doug. When you want to revive a big thing like that, 8 or 10 years. But what the heck, I guess I deserve it. So maybe tomorrow I'll go down and turn myself in.
I'll go with you, Doug.
No, sir, said Doug.
Yes, I will.
You're not going anywhere without old Tom.
Tom, said Doug,
I got only one thing to say to you.
What?
I'm glad I've got you for a younger brother.
Doug turned, his face flushed, and started to walk out of the room.
I think I can make you gladder, said Tom.
Doug halted.
When you think about the money, said Tom, what if the whole gang of us, the whole mob, went up in the clock tower and cleaned it up? If we did the whole machine over somehow? We couldn't repair the whole darn thing, no, but we could spend a couple hours and make it look right and maybe run right. Maybe we could save all the expenses and save you from being a slave for the rest of your life.
I don't know, said Doug.
We could give it a try, said Tom. Ask Grandpa. He'll ask the courthouse people if they'll let us up there again, this time with lots of polish and oil and sweat. And maybe we could bring the darn dead machine back to life. It's gotta work. It's gonna work, Doug. Let's do it.
Doug turned and walked back to Tom's bed and sat on the edge.
Dibs on some of that ice cream, he said.
Sure, said Tom. You get the first bite.
Chapter 26. The next day at noon, Douglas walked home from school to have lunch. When he got there, his mother sent him straight next door to his grandparents' house. Grandpa was waiting, sitting in his favorite chair in a pool of light from his favorite lamp, in the library, where all was stillness and all the books on the shelves were standing alert and ready to be read. Hearing the front door open, Grandpa, without looking up from his book, said,
Douglas?
Yeah?
Come in, boy, and sit down.
It wasn't often that Grandpa offered you a chance to sit down, which meant there was very serious business ahead. Douglas entered quietly and sat on the sofa across from Grandpa and waited. Finally, Grandpa put aside his book, which was also a sign of the serious nature of things, and took off his gold-rimmed specs, which was even more serious, and looked at Douglas with what could only be called a piercing stare.
Now, Doug, he said, I've been reading one of my favorite authors, Mr. Conan Doyle, and one of my favorite characters in all the books by Conan Doyle is Mr. Sherlock Holmes. He has honed my spirit and sharpened my aspects. So on a day like today, I woke up feeling very much like that detective on Baker Street in London a long time ago.
Yes, sir, said Douglas quietly.
I've been putting together bits and pieces of information, and it seems to me that right now the town is afflicted by lots of boys who are suddenly staying home from school, sick, they say, or something or other. Number one is this. I heard tell from Grandma this morning a full report from your house next door. It seems that your brother Tom is doing poorly.
I wouldn't say that exactly, said Doug.
Well, if you won't, I will, said Grandpa. He feels poorly enough to stay home from school. It's not often Tom feels poorly. He's usually so full of pep and energy, I rarely see him when he isn't running. You have any idea about his affliction, Doug?
No, sir, said Doug.
I would hate to contradict you, boy, but I think you do know. But wait for me to add up all the other clues. I got a list here of the boys in your group, the ones I regularly see running under the apple trees or climbing in them or kicking the can down the street. They're usually the ones with firecrackers in one hand and a lit match in the other. At this, Douglas shut his eyes and swallowed hard. I made it my business, said Grandpa, to call the homes of all those boys, and strange to say, they're all in bed. That seems most peculiar, Doug. Can you give me any reason why? Those boys are usually like squirrels on the sidewalk. You can't see 'em, they move so fast. But they're all feeling sick, sleeping late. How about you, Doug?
I'm fine.
Really?
Yes, sir.
You don't look so fine to me. In fact, you look a little bit under the weather. Taking that, together with the boys missing school and Tom feeling poorly, and here you are looking kind of pale around the gills, I figure there must have been some great commotion somewhere last night.
Grandpa stopped and picked up a piece of paper he'd been holding on his lap.
I got a phone call a little earlier from the courthouse clerk. It seems they found a whole lot of firecracker paper somewhere in the city hall this morning. Now that is a most peculiar place to find burnt firecracker paper. The clerk told me they're going to have to do quite a lot of repairs in city hall. They don't say quite what it is they have to fix, but the bill is sizable, and I figure if we apportion it out to various homesteads in the town, it will come to about...
Here, Grandpa put his glasses back on his fine big nose before continuing.
$70.90 per homestead. Now, most of the people I know around here don't have that kind of money. In order to get it, the people in those homes will have to work quite a few days, or maybe weeks, or who knows, months. Would you like to see the list of repairs that have to be done in City Hall, Doug? I've got it right here.
I don't think so, said Doug.
I think you'd better look and study, boy. Here goes.
He handed the piece of paper to Doug. Doug stared at the list. His eyes were so fogged that he couldn't read it. The numbers were immense, and they seemed to extend far into the future. Not just weeks or months, but, oh my gosh, years.
Doug, I want you to do me a favor, said Grandpa. I want you to take this list and play the part of doctor. I want you to make a series of house calls when school lets out for the day. First of all, go over to your house and see how Tom is doing. Tell him that Grandpa wants him to buy a couple of Eskimo pies and come over and eat them on the front porch with me this afternoon. Say that to Tom, Doug, and see if his face doesn't brighten up.
Yes, sir, said Doug.
Then, later, I want you to go to all the other boys' houses and see how your friends are doing. Afterward, come back and give me a report, because all those boys who are lying low need something to make them sit up in bed. I'll be waiting for you. Does that seem fair to you?
Yes, sir, said Doug, and stood up. Grandpa, can I say something?
What's that, Doug?
You're pretty great, Grandpa.
Grandpa mused over that for a few moments before saying, Not great, Doug, just perceptive. Have you ever looked that word up in Webster's dictionary?
No, sir.
Well, before you leave, open Mr. Webster and see what he has to say.
Chapter 27. It was getting late, and they were still up in the clock tower, nine boys working and cleaning out the firecracker dust and bits of burnt paper. It made a neat little pile outside the door. It was a hot evening, and all the boys were perspiring and talking under their breath and wishing they were somewhere else, almost wishing they were in school, which would be better than this. When Doug looked out the clock tower window, he could see Grandpa standing down below, looking up, very quietly. When Grandpa saw Doug looking down, he nodded at him and gave him the merest wave with the stub of his cigar. Finally, the last twilight was gone, and full darkness descended, and the janitor came in. There was lubricant to be put on the big cog and wheels of the clock. The boys watched with a mixture of fascination and fear. Here was their nemesis, which they thought they'd defeated, being brought back to life. And they'd helped. In the weak light from a naked ceiling bulb, they watched as the janitor wound up the great spring and stood back. There was a rasping shudder from deep within the great clock's innards, and as if afflicted, the boys moved away, shivering. The big clock began to tick, and the boys knew it wouldn't be long till the hour would strike, so they backed off and fled out the door, down the stairs, with Doug following and Tom leading the way. The mob met Grandpa in the middle of the courthouse lawn, and he gave each of them a pat on the head or the shoulder. Then the other boys ran to their homes, leaving Tom and Doug and Grandpa to walk a block to the corner, where the United Cigar Store still stood open because it was Saturday night. The last of the Saturday night strollers were starting to drift home, and Grandpa picked out the finest cigar he could find, cut it, and lit it from the eternal flame that stood on the cigar store counter. He puffed contentedly and looked with quiet satisfaction upon his two grandsons.
Well done, boys, he said. Well done.
Then the sound that they didn't want to hear came. The great clock was clearing its throat in the tower and struck its first note. Bong! One by one, the town lights began to go out. Bong! Grandpa turned and nodded and gestured with his cigar for the boys to follow him home. They crossed the street and walked up the block as the great clock struck another note and another, which shivered the air and trembled their blood. The boys grew pale. Grandpa looked down and pretended not to notice. All the town's lights were now out, and they had to find their way in the dark, with only the merest sliver of moon in the sky to lead the way. They walked away from the clock and its terrible sound, which echoed in their blood and compelled all the people in the town toward their destinies. They went down past the ravine where, maybe, a new lonely one was hiding, and might come up at any moment and grab hold. Doug looked out and saw the black silhouette of the haunted house perched on the edge of the ravine, and wondered. Then at last, in the total dark, as the last peal of the great clock faded away, they ambled up the sidewalk, and Grandpa said, Sleep well, boys. God bless. The boys ran home to their beds. They could feel, though they did not hear, the great clock ticking and the future rushing upon them in the black night. In the dark, Doug heard Tom say from his room across the hall,
Doug?
What?
That wasn't so hard after all.
No, said Doug. Not so hard.
We did it. At least we put things back the way they should be.
I don't know about that, said Doug.
But I know, said Tom, because that darn clock is going to make the sun rise. I can hardly wait.
Then Tom was asleep, and Doug soon followed. Chapter 28.
Bong!
Calvin C. Quartermain stirred in his sleep and slowly rose to an upright position.
Bong!
The great clock, striking midnight. He felt himself, half-crippled, making it to the window and opening it wide to the sound of the great clock.
Bong!
It can't be, he murmured to himself. Not dead. Not dead. They fixed the damned thing. Call the others first thing in the morning. Maybe it's over. Maybe it's done. Anyway, the town's running again the way it's supposed to. And tomorrow I have to figure out what to do next.
He reached up and found an odd thing on his mouth. A smile. He put his hand up to catch it, and if possible, examine it.
Could be the weather, he thought. Could be the wind. It's just right. Or maybe I had some sort of twisted dream. What was I dreaming? Now that the clock is alive again, I've got to figure it out. The war is almost over, but how do I finish it? And how do I win?
Quartermain leaned out the window and gazed at the moon, a silver sliver in the midnight sky. The moon, the clock, his creaking bones. Quartermain recalled numberless nights spent looking out the window at the sleeping town, although in years past his back was not stooped, his joints not stiff. In years past, looking out this very window, he was young, fit as a fiddle, full of piss and vinegar, just like those boys.
Wait a minute. Whose birthday's next? He wondered, trying to call up school record sheets in his mind. One of the monsters? What a chance that would be! I'll kill them with kindness, change my spots, dress in a dog suit, hide the mean cat inside. They won't know what hit them.
Chapter 29. It was such a day that all the doors stood open and all the window sashes had been up since dawn. No one could stay in. Everyone was out. Nobody would die. Everyone would live forever. It was more spring than farewell summer, more Eden than Illinois. During the night, a rain had come to quench the heat, and in the morning, with the clouds hastened off, each tree in all the yards gave off a separate and private rain if you shook it in passing. Quartermain, out of bed and whirring through the house in hand-propelled trajectories, again found that odd thing, a smile on his mouth. He kicked the kitchen door wide and flung himself, eyes glittering, the smile pinned to his thin lips, into the presence of his servants and the cake.
Good morning, Mr. Cal, said the cook.
The cake stood like a magnificent Alp upon the kitchen table. To the odors of morning were added the smells of snow upon a white mountain, the aroma of frosted blossoms and candied roses, of petal-pink candles and translucent icing. There it was, like a distant hill in a dream of the future. The cake as white as noon clouds, the cake in the shape of collected years, each candle ready for the lighting and blowing out.
That, he whispered. Oh, my God, that will do it! Take it down to the ravine. Get!
The housekeeper and the gardener picked up the white mountain. The cook led the way, opening the door. They carried it out the door and down the porch and across the garden.
Who could resist a sweet thing like that? A dream, thought Quartermain. Watch it!
The housekeeper slipped on the dew-wet grass. Quartermain shut his eyes.
No, God, no!
When he opened his eyes again, the servants were still marching steadily, perspiring, down the hill into the green ravine, toward the clear waters, under the high, cool, shadowy trees, toward the birthday table.
Thank you, murmured Quartermain, and added, God.
Below in the ravine, the cake was set upon the table, and it was white, and it glowed,
and it was perfect.
Chapter 30.
There,
said Mother, fixing his tie.
Who cares about a darn girl's birthday party? Said Douglas. It sounds awful. If Quartermain can go to all the trouble to have a cake made for Lisabelle, you can take an hour and go, especially since he sent invitations. Be polite is all I ask.
Come on, Doug! Oh, come on! Cried Tom from the front porch.
Hold your horses. Here I go.
And the screen door slammed, and he was in the street, and he and Tom were walking in the fresh day.
Boy, whispered Tom, smiling, I'm going to eat till I get thick.
There's a deep and dire plot in here somewhere, said Douglas.
How come all of a sudden Quartermain isn't making a commotion? How come just like that he's all smiles?
I never in my life, said Tom, argued with a piece of cake or a bowl of ice cream.
Halfway down the block, they were joined by Charlie, who fell into step beside them and looked like he was going to a funeral.
Hey, this tie's killing me.
Charlie walked with them in a solemn line. Moments later, they were joined by Will and the others.
As soon as the party's over, let's all go skinny dipping out at Apple Creek. Might be our last chance before it gets too cold. Summer's gone.
Doug said, Am I the only one who thinks there's something fishy going on here? I mean, why's old man Quartermain giving Lisabelle a birthday party? Why'd he invite us? I smell a rat, fellas. Charlie tugged at his tie and said,
I hate to say this, Doug, but it looks like any day now whatever's left of our war ain't going to be nothing. There doesn't seem to be any reason to fight them anymore.
I don't know, Charlie. Something just doesn't add up.
They came to the ravine and stopped.
Well, here we are, said Douglas. Keep your eyes peeled. If I give the word, break and scatter. You fellas go ahead, said Douglas. I'll be down in a minute. I've got some strategizing to do.
Reluctantly, they left him and started down the hill. After they had gone 100 feet, they began to shuffle and then lope and then run, yelling. They pulled up below by the tables, and from a distance, here and there through the ravine, like white birds skimming the grass, came the girls, running too, all gathered in one place, and there was Calvin C. Quartermain, reeling down the pathway in a wheelchair, calling out in a high and cheerful voice.
Hell, said Douglas, standing back alone. I mean, heck.
The children gathered, shoving and pushing and laughing. Seen from a distance, they were like little figures on a beautiful stage. Their laughter came drifting up to Douglas, and his mouth twitched. And then, beyond the children, resplendent on its own white cloth table, was the birthday cake. Douglas stared. It rose tier upon tier, of such a size that it towered like a snowman, magnificent and shining in the sun.
Doug! Hey, Doug!
Voices drifted up to him, but he didn't hear. The cake, the white and beautiful cake, a piece of winter saved from years ago, cool and snowy now in the late summer day. The cake, the white and magnificent cake, frost and rime and snowflakes, apple flower and lily bud, and the voices laughing and the laughter rolling up to him where he stood alone and separate, and their voices calling, Doug!
Come on! Ah, Doug, come down! Hey, Doug! Aw, come on!
His eyes were blinded by the frost and the snow of it. He felt his feet propelling him down into the ravine, and he knew he was moving toward the table and the white vision, and there was no way to stop his feet, no way to turn his eyes away, and all thoughts of battle plans and troop movements fled from his mind. He began to shuffle, and he began to lope, and then he ran faster and faster, and reaching a large tree, he grabbed hold to catch his breath. He heard himself whisper, Hi. And everyone, looking at him in the light of the snow mountain, in the glare of the wintry hill, replied, Hi. And he joined the party. There was Lisabelle. Among the others, she stood, her face as delicate as the curlicues on the frosted cake. Her lips soft
and pink as the birthday candles. Her great eyes fixed him where he stood. He was suddenly conscious of the grass under his shoes. His throat was dry. His tongue filled his mouth. The children milled round and round, with Lisabelle at the center of their carousel. Quatermain came hurtling along the rough path, his wheelchair almost flying and nearly crashed into the table. He gave a cry and sat on the outer edge of the milling crowd, a look of immense satisfaction on his creased yellow face. And then Mr. Bleak appeared and stood behind the wheelchair, smiling an altogether different kind of smile. Douglas watched as Lisabelle bent toward the cake. The soft scent of the candles wafted on the breeze. And there was her face, like a summer peach, beautiful and warm, and the light of the candles reflected in her dark eyes. Douglas held his breath. The entire world waited and held its breath. Quatermain was frozen, gripping his chair as if it were his own body threatening to run off with him. 14 candles. 14 years to be snuffed out and a goal set toward one more as good or better. Lisabelle seemed happy. She was floating down the great river of time and enjoying the trip, blissful with her journeying. The happiness of the insane was in her eye and hand. She exhaled a great breath, the smell of a summer apple. The candles snuffed out. The boys and girls crowded to the cake as Lisabelle picked up a great silver knife. The sun glinted off its edge in flashes that seared the eyes. She cut the cake and pushed the slice with the knife and slipped it onto a plate. This plate she picked up and held with two hands. The cake was white and soft and sweet-looking. Everyone stared at it. Old Man Quatermain grinned like an idiot. Bleak smiled sadly.
"Who shall I give the first piece to?" Lisabelle cried.
She deliberated so long it seemed she must be putting a part of herself into the soft color and spun sugar of the frosting. She took two slow steps forward. She was not smiling now. Her face was gravely serious. She held out the cake upon the plate and handed it to Douglas. She stood before Doug and moved her face so close to his that he could feel her breath on his cheeks. Douglas, startled, jumped back. Shocked, Lisabelle opened her eyes as she cried softly a word he could not at first hear.
"Coward," she cried. "And not only that," she added, "scaredy cat." "Don't listen, Doug," said Tom.
"Yeah, you don't have to take that," said Charlie.
Douglas moved back another step, blinking. Douglas held the plate in his hands, and the children stood around him. He did not see Quatermain wink at Bleak and jab him with his elbow. He saw only Lisabelle's face. It was a face with snow in it, with cherries and water and grass, and it was a face like this late afternoon. It was a face that looked into him. He felt as if somehow she had touched him, here, there, upon the eyelids, the ears, the nose. He shivered. He took a bite of cake.
"Well," said Lisabelle, "got nothing to say? If you're scared down here, I bet you're even more scared up there."
She pointed upward toward the far edge of the ravine.
"Tonight," she said, "we're all going to be there. I bet you won't even show up."
Doug looked from her up to the top of the ravine, and there stood the haunted house where in the daytime the boys sometimes gathered, but where they never dared to go at night.
"Well," said Lisabelle, "what are you waiting for? Will you be there or not?" "Doug," said Tom, "you don't have to take that. Give her what for, Doug?"
Doug looked from Lisabelle's face up to the heights of the ravine, and again to the haunted house. The cake melted in Douglas's mouth. Between looking at the house and trying to decide, with the cake in his mouth, sugar melting on his tongue, he didn't know what to do. His heart was beating wildly, and his face was a confusion of blood.
"I'll..." he blurted.
"You'll what?"
taunted Lisabelle.
"Be there," he said.
That a boy, Doug, said Tom.
Don't let her fool you, said Bo.
But Doug turned away from his friends. Suddenly a memory came to him. Years ago, he had killed a butterfly on a bush, smashing it with a stick, for no reason at all other than it seemed like the thing to do. Glancing up, he had seen his grandfather, like a framed picture, startled on the porch above him. Douglas dropped the stick and picked up the shattered flakes of butterfly, the bright pieces of sun and grass. He tried to fit it back together again and breathe a spell of life into it, but at last, crying, he said,
I'm sorry.
And then Grandpa had spoken, saying, Remember, always, everything moves. Thinking of the butterfly, he was reminded of Quatermain. The trees shook with wind, and suddenly he was looking out of Quatermain's face, and he knew how it felt to be inside a haunted house alone. He went to the birthday table and picked up a plate with the largest piece of cake on it, and began to walk toward Quatermain. There was a starched look in the old man's face, then a searching of the boy's eyes and chin and nose with a sunless gaze. Douglas stopped before the wheelchair. Mr. Quatermain, he said. He pushed the plate out onto the warm air into Quatermain's hands. At first, the old man's hands did not move. Then, as if wakened, his fingers opened with surprise. Quatermain regarded the gift with utter bewilderment.
Thank you, he said, so low no one heard him.
He touched a fragment of white frosting to his mouth. Everyone was very quiet.
Criminy, Doug,
Bo hissed as he pulled Doug away from the wheelchair.
Why'd you do that? Is it Armistice Day? You could let me rip off your epaulets? Why'd you give that cake to that awful old gink?
Because, Douglas thought, but didn't say, because, well, I could hear him breathe. Chapter 31
I've lost, thought Quatermain. I've lost the game. Check. Mate.
Bleak pushed Quatermain in his wheelchair, like a load of dried apricots and yellow wicker, around the block under the dying afternoon sun. He hated the tears that brimmed in his eyes.
My God, he cried. What happened?
Bleak said he wasn't sure whether it was a significant loss or a small victory.
Don't small victory me, Quatermain shouted.
All right, said Bleak, I won't.
All of a sudden, said Quatermain, in the boys...
He stopped, for he could not breathe.
Face,
he continued,
in the boy's face.
Quatermain touched his mouth with his hands to pull the words out. He had seen himself peer forth from the boy's eyes, as if from an opened door.
How did I get in there? How?
Bleak said nothing, but pushed Quatermain on through sun and shadow quietly. Quatermain did not touch the handwheels of his moving chair. He slumped, staring rigidly beyond the moving trees, the flowing white river of sidewalk.
What happened?
If you don't know, said Bleak, I won't tell you.
I thought I defeated them. I thought I was mean and smart and clever. But I didn't win.
No, said Bleak.
I don't understand. Everything was set up for me to win.
You did them a favor. You made them put one foot in front of the other.
Is that what I did? So it's their victory. They might not know it, but yes. Every time you take a step, even when you don't want to, said Bleak. When it hurts, when it means you rub chins with death, or even if it means dying, that's good. Anything that moves ahead wins. No chess game was ever won by the player who sat for a lifetime thinking over his next move.
Quatermain let himself be pushed another block in silence, and then said,
Brayling was a fool.
The metronome?
Yes.
Bleak shook his head.
He might be alive today if he hadn't scared himself to death. He thought he could stand still or even run backward. He thought he could trick life. Tricked himself right into a fine oration at a quick burial.
They turned a corner.
Oh, it's hard to let go, said Quatermain. All my life I've held on to everything I ever touched. Preach to me, Bleak.
Bleak, obediently, preached.
Learning to let go should be learned before learning to get. Life should be touched, not strangled. You've got to relax. Let it happen at times, and at others move forward with it. It's like boats. You keep your motor on so you can steer with the current. When you hear the sound of the waterfall coming nearer and nearer, tidy up the boat, put on your best tie and hat, and smoke a cigar right up till the moment you go over. That's a triumph. Don't argue with the cataract. Take me around the block again.
Here we go.
End of Disc 2.